the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina. It's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax. But buckle up and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. We've got a special guest today, Eric Peterson. He's the Director of Policy for the Pelican Center for Technology and Innovation. And he has got a dust storm, I think from Saharan Africa or the big desert over there. Eric, Brooke, how's it going today?
It's going well, and I need to hear about this dust storm. As if 2020 didn't already have enough drama in it. Eric, how are you faring down there south?
Well, I'm looking out the window right now, Brooke, and we're doing pretty well, but the dust storm is supposed to be coming in to most of the south this weekend. I got to say, I'm hoping it turns out like Tropical Storm Cristobal, which wasn't too bad for those of us in New Orleans. A little bad for some of the folks in the outskirts of Louisiana. But we are certainly tired of our apocalyptic biblical weather down here in Louisiana.
I mean, so what's been your favorite plague, though, so far in 2020 then? Because, yes, I get that the weather's an issue, but have any of them been particularly, I don't know, fascinating to you, interesting, especially biblical?
You know, I really think the murder hornets kind of came and went really quickly. I don't think they got nearly as much news coverage as they probably deserved. I don't know if it was that the murder hornets had great PR and were able to get, you know, down to like killer bees status, and that we all kind of forgot about them. But yeah, I really want to know what happened to the murder hornets.
That one kind of came and went. That's true. What about you, Ray? You got a favorite plague?
Well, I was very interested in the killer bees. Was it bees or wasps?
The murder hornets, like what Eric was talking about.
The murder hornets. I think that was probably my favorite. I've lived through quite a few dust storms. While they kind of seem dramatic, just from a, you know, an optic standpoint, it's not really that dramatic. You're going to have to wash your car or do something like that. But it's not a big deal. And especially people, if you've ever lived in L.A. or been to L.A., the smog and the dust storm looks very similar.
Yeah, I gotta say though, for Louisiana, we are not used to our dust. It is hot and humid. It rains all the time, so it will certainly be a new experience for a lot of us down here.
Yeah, you probably get a rainstorm as soon as it is over or passes by, and it'll wash most of that away. Because you know, you always get that late afternoon showers down there when it's so humid.
Yes, it is. We are in summer storm season, absolutely, where we get more flooding. You know, for a few hours. We got a bad one yesterday, and then 3 hours later, it's back to normal.
You know, I think I would be okay if 2020 is going to get any worse. Like, I'm really just hoping it's the first half of 2020 that is as crazy as it has been, and then the second half of the year just turns out to be amazing. But if we have to get another plague, I'm trying to think of which one I would want. I used to love that story in the Bible about the plagues of Egypt, but that was because I wasn't actually living through it. So if I had to choose another one, I guess I would choose locusts, maybe. I would choose locusts or the river turning red.
Ooh, I don't know. Turning red would be kind of cool.
Yeah, that happened in Russia, I think, didn't it? Because of the chemical reaction of something. I don't know. I saw some headline about a river turning red in Russia.
I got to say, well, A, everything turns red in Russia, especially when the Soviet Union was taking over. But yep. I am a big fan of when they dye the river green in Chicago every year. That is one of my favorite things to see. So I would be down for if our rivers turn green and we got to re-celebrate St. Patrick's Day. I think that would be great for everyone.
That is cool, yeah. I mean, anytime you go to the Midwest, there's always some great St. Patrick Day celebrations. I remember when I was working at the Acting Institute, you'd walk outside the building at like 11 a.m., and there were drunks all over the street for St. Patrick's Day. And you don't see that quite as much in the South or the Deep South as you might see in the Midwest, or maybe in parts of the Northeast, too.
Yeah, you certainly see it in New Orleans when people are out and about, but Bourbon Street has yet to really reopen to its former glory, unfortunately.
Well, this has been a lovely conversation, but we really want to, we wanted to have you on to discuss Section 230 and bring our audience to speed up on really some of the regulations that govern our online interactions. As we know, that's pretty much one of the only ways that we interact with one another during a time like this when everyone's on lockdown. And so there's just been a lot of talk about canceling different shows, canceling different people, monuments, things like that. And then there are many calls regarding censorship and accusing big social media tech companies of censorship. So we wanted you to provide a little bit more insight into really what that's about and where the argument is at the moment.
Yeah, thanks, Brooke. A lot of people misunderstand Section 230. It's under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. And like you said, it governs how we interact with each other online. I'm actually going to read it for you because it's only 26 words. All it says is, no publisher or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as a publisher or speaker for any information provided by another information content provider. All that means is that somebody who is hosting a website and has user-created content is not responsible for what other people post up on that website. So that could be anything from a comment section on Fox News or CNN or the New York Times or Facebook or Twitter or Reddit or Instagram or one of the hundreds of other websites that allow user-generated content. Unfortunately, it's kind of come in under attack, as you've talked about. It's become this really big political football, but really it lets the internet as we know it kind of work today. There's been everything from an executive order from the Trump administration to quite a few bills pushed forward in Congress that could restrict Sections 230 protection. And the worrying thing for people like me who believe that Section 230 has been great for online speech is that it's coming from both sides of the political aisle, but for very, very different reasons.
And so can you highlight maybe some of the competing reasons to go after Section 230 on the left and on the right? I know that I believe Senator Klobuchar had presented some sort of tech restraints. I don't know if it particularly dealt with Section 230 or not, or if that was just more an antitrust thing. But we also definitely know that our president has gone after Twitter multiple times, claiming censorship. So can you talk a little bit about the competing political aspects of this?
Yeah. Senator Klobuchar and a lot of people are going after big tech companies for being big and antitrust stuff, which we don't have time to do on this show unless we want to take another 45 minutes. But the rub on Section 230 is generally those who are complaining about it from the left think that there's too much content being left up, that people are saying things online that are dangerous, that can hurt communities or are content that they just don't want to see. And they think that Section 230 needs to be taken down so that websites like Twitter or Facebook are liable for what their users write. And therefore, people like they'll take more of that content down. Conservatives or people on the right are complaining about censorship, and they think that these platforms are taking down too much of this speech, and they think that they're acting in a non-politically neutral way, and that if they go after Section 230 and get rid of these protections, that they will be more fair and leave up more conservative or right-wing content, which is, again, very interesting because they've both go on in on this one section as the cause of their problems and think amending it or removing it is a solution, but they want drastically different outcomes, or they foresee drastically different outcomes if this section of law is changed.
Eric, what ways can there be more equity in some of these big techs, which really operate in some fashion as an oligarchy, but what ways? Because we're seeing the president's tweets, whether you like President Trump or not, we're seeing them being censored online directly. I mean, I can go and scroll through his Twitter feed, and I see several just from the last couple of weeks that were censored. What can conservatives do about this? Is it just a matter of just keep complaining and hope that big tech acts in a little bit more equitable manner, since they do trumpet themselves as supporting free speech and supporting people's right to express themselves? I mean, what are the answers here?
Yeah, you bring up a good question, Ray. I guess one of the things I would say is, what are we defining as censorship, right? In some ways, a lot of people who are very popular on these platforms get a lot more leash than you or I might for all the complaints about President Trump being censored. Obviously, you know, the major cable news companies are running those tweets. You can still see the tweets. All you have to do is click them.
They come with warnings that they're offensive. I mean, do you find that problematic at all?
You know, I think people can you know, have a reasonable disagreement on whether they're offensive or not, or whether Twitter was doing the right thing by labeling them offensive. But censorship suggests that there's no way for us to view them. And I don't think that's the right way to look about it. I would say, though, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on Twitter today. There are a lot of folks who have had these complaints are moving to an app called Parler. That has held itself up as a place of free expression that won't censor views of people like President Trump. And there's a lot of people who support the president who have moved onto that app. Senator Ted Cruz cut a video, which he released on Twitter, urging people to go to Parler. So I think at the end of the day, it's going to come up to competition. And while a lot of folks will say that people have a monopoly, we are certainly old enough to remember when MySpace was called the, you know, dominant social media platform and nobody was going to stop them. Of course, MySpace is pretty much gone. And as a millennial, I am very scared at these Zoomers and their TikToks that they are making. I don't understand them. I want no part of them. But a lot of folks are certainly using them right now. And that has kind of jumped off in just the past year. And there's a lot of articles being written about how TikTok has become even more popular during quarantine.
So you don't think that some of these big tech companies, Facebook, YouTube, Google are probably perhaps the biggest perpetrator in some of this from some of their search methods. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk about this in the presidential race, that there's an unfair advantage for the left because they're utilizing their space to de-emphasize certain conservative thought or conservative figures while elevating other figures. Do you think this is a problem going forward, especially when it comes to kind of fairness in election? We've got media rules on this. I mean, is this a problem at all? Or you don't see this as a problem in any fashion or form if they're going to target conservatives?
So I just don't think overall that there's been a ton of conservative targeting in a kind of top-down way. That's not to say that they have acted perfectly in every circumstance. That would be impossible, right? We're looking at billions of posts a day. They have to make decisions on each and every one of them. So even if they're 99.9% right, that's still going to be a lot that are going to cause some issues. But let me just take a look at the top performing Facebook posts today. They are from the top two are from Franklin Graham. Number three is from Fox News. Number four is Mark Levin. Number five is Fox News. Tabitha Brown, six. Mike Rowe, seven. Don Bugino, who I don't know, is at eight or nine. And the 10th most top performing post is USA Patriots for Donald Trump. That certainly sounds like conservatives are doing pretty well on Facebook. President Trump did pretty well on Facebook in 2016. You know, it seems that he had a really good way of using it, and seems to kind of still be using it effectively. So for a lot of concerns that, these companies are kind of unfairly putting a scale on the election one way or the other, you know, the data doesn't seem to be pointing that out right now.
I just have a real problem when I look and I'm scrolling through my Twitter feed and I see a warning from Twitter saying, this is offensive. Some people find this offensive and then they block viewing of it. I know you can click around it and all that, but there's something inherently that bothers me about that. And it bothers me that there's certain people on the right that say, it's not a big deal. They're a private company. They can do what they want. And look, I mean, here's the thing. These tech companies are acting as a monopoly in this manner. They're trying to control in influence and editorialized speech, and it bothers me. And I feel like it should bother more people. Do you not feel that way at all? I mean, you not, you're just sort of like, well, there's other companies that are going to come along and it'll sort this thing out. And so to me, there's just something inherent and visceral, kind of a gut reaction that says there's something not right about this, especially when we see a prevalence of the culture with these big tech companies moving in one sort of direction. I mean, there's something that just doesn't add up. Eric, I don't know if you can address that more, if you just want to kind of just say, well, it's kind of okay because there's other organizations that are going to come along and they're not ultimately a monopoly at the end of the day.
Well, let me address 2 points there. One is what you're saying. And I think, you know, there's reason that some people do feel that Twitter is treating them unfairly, making them click through to see Donald Trump's post. But
Why Donald Trump and not others, I guess? I mean, sure. Why nothing about Pelosi and what she said about Republicans wanting they don't want to pay for George Floyd's murder? I mean, so just help us navigate that aspect of it, I guess.
Yeah, so I don't want to go into each individual content moderating decision other than to say when people are going after Section 230, I think there's a big disconnect there, right? They say that, oh, Twitter's got this special carve-out and protection. All 230 does is say that Twitter's not liable for what Nancy Pelosi or Donald Trump or any politician or you and I tweet. Section 230 does not protect Twitter, however, from what they put on Donald Trump's tweet. And I think that's really important and often missed when people talk about this sort of conversation and as if we fix Section 230 and Twitter won't be able to put that warning on President Trump's tweet anymore. The other thing I would say is you kind of point out this monopoly. I think for those of us who are on social media and use social media to get the news, we kind of think of it as the only way to get news because we're on it so much. And that nobody cares more about what's happening on Twitter than the people who are on Twitter too much. But of course, there's all kinds of other ways to get our news, from reading a newspaper to going on FoxNews.com to, you know, watching cable news, to watching broadcast news, to listening to talk radio, to listening to podcasts. So this idea that social media are the only people who have a monopoly on what people are reading or hearing or seeing, I just don't think is very accurate for where our people get stuff from. You know, my parents certainly aren't on Twitter.
Okay, so that I think is an excellent point, because I believe that a lot of this can be boiled down into agency. Americans have agency as to where they choose to get their news from. And I, for one, do not trust the government to effectively police content from private companies very well. They don't do a very good job of it. I mean, look how botched up they handled data regarding coronavirus. I don't trust them to handle this sort of information correctly, but I do trust American people to choose where they get their news from and to click an extra button. I mean, it's clear that Twitter has a bias against President Trump and maybe even against some conservatives, but the recourse that an American has to petition a company for a redress of their grievances seems to go a lot faster than it would in the federal or even state systems if there was an issue. I mean, look at how long it took for charges to be filed against the officer regarding Breonna Taylor's no-knock warrant death. Whereas if Linda Sarsour, what's her name? No, the girl on the right, not Linda Sarsour, she's on the left. But when some female conservative gets canceled on Twitter or Facebook, she raises heck and she's able to get her account reinstated fairly quickly. So even that, I mean, as imperfect as it is, American people have choices and they have a voice in this much more to a greater degree than I think they do when it relates to how we interact with our government.
I totally agree with that. I also see some of these actions that are operating or some of the big tech actions are a threat to liberty. And I think it's okay to say that. I mean, I totally see censorship going on. I mean, you can see it. You can read about it. There's credible sources out there pointing it out. There's been people that have been kicked off of Twitter. I mean, I don't agree with many of those people. I don't like what they're saying. But I think it's a mistake to just kind of pick and choose because you don't agree with somebody politically that I'm going to censor them. I know they're a private organization, they're a private company, but they don't act like that in terms of, you know, with the way that they've scaled up, content, the way that they control some of the debate out there. And so I think it's a legitimate concern of conservatives. I don't think asking the government to go in and break it up and to, you know, use antitrust laws to break it up is the right answer. But I feel like there's some sort of middle ground that maybe has not been explored yet, because it's a big problem going forward. And the more and more communication that goes online is going to have a dramatic impact, I feel like, on the culture. It's going to have a dramatic impact. And some of those are just realities, I understand that. But it's going to have a dramatic impact on who we allow, you know, to run for president. If you don't have the support of Google, you know, if Google's not going to put your content out there or highlight some of your content or hide some of your content, that's a big problem. And for people to say that's not a problem, I think is a big mistake, especially for people on the right or who want to advocate for ultimately for free markets and in a fair society.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you talk about free markets, and if Google decided to stop running somebody as influential as our president's, you know, content, right? If he just disappeared from all Google searches, my guess is that would be very good for Bing or Yahoo or DuckDuckGo. You know, they have a large incentive to not do that when we talk about these sorts of things. But, you know, it just kind of looking back in the history for 20, 30 years, it's just really worrying to me, to people, to ask the government to solve this problem when, you know, the last time the government got involved in fairness was the Fairness Doctrine, and that stopped, you know, kind of conservative radio. It wasn't until Reagan got rid of it that Rush Limbaugh really got on the scene. And now we have Fox News and, you know, all these sorts of things. We have more access to conservative content and kind of heterodox voices than we have had at any point in human history. And now we seem to be going after the part of the internet in terms of law that makes that all possible.
I think it's a big problem when you have Twitter basically, look, censoring the president. He's democratically elected president. You know, all of us probably have problems with Donald Trump. But then a lot of big tech, you know, they allow China to spread misinformation on Twitter. I've read several articles pointing this out, pointing out certain tweets of you know, spreading propaganda for China. No warning labels with that, Eric. None at all.
Yeah, and I'm not here to defend any company's, you know, particular moderating choices. You know, I've worked on some workshops on moderating particular content, and it's hard. Companies certainly make mistakes all across the board, just because there are millions and millions of tweets a day, right? And I won't defend them, but what I will defend is that the rules that we've had that have allowed the American internet to flourish, and then have given more voices to more people than has ever been happened before in human history.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. And obviously, there's been a lot of democratic revolutions in the Middle East and other parts of the world that have been buoyed by social media, obviously. And that's a good thing, ultimately. But I do think it's a problem. I mean, I just don't know how to get away from it and say, you know, there's not problems going on with this. And I understand that government intervention is completely problematic at the same time. But it's something I think conservatives need to be aware of and plugged into. And I don't know if the answer is like, well, they're just a private organization. They can do what they want. They can keep censoring the president. I don't know if that's a good enough answer going forward. And so I think it's something to watch.
If Donald Trump feels that he is being unfairly censored by Twitter, he is, of course, welcome to go to any other online platform. And I am sure there will be millions of people who will follow him there. And cable news will continue to keep covering however he posts. He has the bully pulpit of the presidency, and obviously whoever is president next will probably have the same deal.
Should we want companies not to censor, though? I mean, can we say that we don't want them to do this? Is that a good thing to say, Eric?
So I would actually say no. Actually,
you want companies to be able to censor people?
Yeah, absolutely. I know that sounds weird.
It does sound weird. I mean,
I agree with it.
We're not talking. We're not talking about, you know, a private corporation in the sense of, hey, you know, I've got an employee here, we're not talking about employees of Twitter. I'm not an employee of Twitter. You're not an employee of Twitter. So I understand that aspect of it. But I just find it really visceral, kind of a visceral reaction to silencing people because we don't agree with them politically on a platform like Twitter, on a platform like Facebook, when they get to pick and choose what is the right speech. That's going to create problems going forward. And you can say, hey, well, you can go over to this other social media site that has 5,000 people in an echo chamber. But, you know, I just don't think that's a good enough response right now. I mean, look, I agree with you about government intervention and not going overboard with that. I'm a free market guy, always have been. But to say that there's no problem, you know, in terms of the way that social media censors online is really problematic to me. And I don't know. I mean, it's just something that bothers me about it when you can kind of scroll and see things. I know people who've been kicked off of Twitter. I know organizations that have been deplatformed before. Some of them come back, some of them don't. But this is a real problem, Eric, and I think you should point that out.
So, you know, I have certainly disagreed with various moderating decisions, and I think a lot of companies have owned up to the fact that they've made poor moderating decisions. But I do think I want on a lot of these websites, I go to them because their content is moderated. At a lot of, you know, in the earlier internet days, there were a lot of you know, message boards that didn't have unmoderated content. You can still go to those sorts of places now. And they're not very popular. And the reason they're not very popular is because there's all kinds of really objectionable content that, frankly, a lot of people just don't want to be subjected to. At the end of these days, these companies want to make sure that they've got eyeballs on them, right? That's how they make money, by selling ads. And part of that is, you know, censoring certain content that people might not want to see. Now, we can argue about when they go too far or maybe they don't go far enough. That's certainly an argument that is playing out not only on this podcast, but on the platforms themselves. But to say that we want the internet to be a total free-for-all, I think would actually be very bad. I think people wouldn't like it at all. And I would suggest that if they think they want the internet to be like that, that they go to some websites that allow completely unmoderated content. And I think they would not want to spend a lot of time there.
It ends up being a cesspool. And I'm going to chime in as someone who moderates a couple of websites, including all of the Civitas asset ones. And I do censor. I do censor as it pertains to if there are trolls on there making fallacious claims against our employees or against others that I believe or know to be patently false, then I moderate that content. And so some might call that censorship, and in a way it is, but it's because there are problematic claims being made that that pose a number of threats in a variety of ways. And so I am grateful for that ability while also knowing that Section 230 would protect me from being liable for any of that abusive content being posted on my website if I didn't happen to catch it in time.
Yeah, I want to
think we should support a culture of free speech online. I get that we have the ability to censor our own websites, to censor our own content. You know, comment sections and all that. Don't totally agree with that. Have no problem. But I think just by and large, just, you know, from a basic understanding, we should want these companies to support free speech. I mean, can everybody agree with that? We want these companies to support free speech. Is that something you all agree with?
I want them to support the First Amendment's proper scope, which is that government has to respect free speech.
Do we want these companies to support free speech? Is that something you guys can get on board with?
I mean, I think the question always is who's free speech, right? And I would agree with Brooke that I certainly don't want the government stepping in on that. But,
What about a culture of free speech? We want these companies to support a culture of free speech. Can we agree with that?
I think you would have to define culture of free speech.
A broad culture in society that we've had for, you know, at least since the Bill of Rights.
But so, Ray, are you saying that private institutions like churches, for example, have to tolerate every and any sort of claim made in their walls and that they should support it for the sake of free speech?
No.
That's not their purview. That's the government's purview.
Not saying that at all. So all I'm saying to both of you is, can we have a broad understanding that we actually want the companies in America to support American values, which includes free speech? Now, I understand that there can be some semantics around that. But do we support speech? Just as a broad influence in our culture, just like we have when we kind of go out in society and culture. I'm not saying that people can't be punished for what they say, but I'm saying, do we want companies, you know, to at least support the basic premise of the First Amendment?
As somebody who used to
censor people on the basis of their speech, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think with the caveat that obviously there is a good purpose for content moderation, that removing abusive speech can be good in terms of creating a culture of free speech, right? A lot of people don't want to speak out or let their opinions known if they feel that they're going to get piled on or harassed. But, you know, as somebody who used to work at the Institute for Free Speech, I certainly believe in a free speech culture. And I think it's part of what makes America great and exceptional. I can agree with that.
That's good. I've been good. I'm in agreement. I get concerned, man. I mean, look, I mean, I got lots of problems with Trump. But that they single him out when they don't single others out, I find that very problematic. I mean, I don't think that's going to, you know, it's going to encourage the values that they actually think that they are putting forward. What it's going to do is make people angrier, make people lash out more. I just don't think that some of the things they're doing are cultivating American values that we've understood for hundreds of years that are ingrained, at least were ingrained in our society. And so I think we should be concerned about some of these companies and how they operate and what they're doing. That doesn't mean that there has to be a certain government position on that. But I think that as long as we understand that and that there's a commonality in terms of there's some threats here, then I think that's important.
Well, I think we need to also recognize that we have free association too. And so free speech, if I value things not being censored, I have the freedom to associate with another company, another social media platform that abides by said values. And so this is really, I think, where this boils down to is I have decision rights in this. I have agency as a individual to be able to say, okay, I don't like Twitter's terms of agreement anymore, so I'm going to leave Twitter. And they can continue to be that, you know, toxic platform that they're going to be, and I'm going to find something elsewhere. And so I don't think any of us doubt or disagree on the very critical American value of free speech. But in so much as a company does not represent that value, I have the freedom to go take my business elsewhere.
Brooke, I got to say, I am very much looking forward to the TikToks of you and your large family dancing to some great, great music.
TikTok's owned by China, Eric. I don't know about that anymore.
all I'm saying is I think we should want companies to support free speech. We should want American companies to be supportive of an energetic, vibrant debate and not censor people. We should want that. I mean, maybe we can't force them to do it, but we should want it.
Okay. Gotcha.
You don't agree with that?
I don't not agree with that either.
American companies to have American values. You don't agree with that?
Yes, I would love to, but I'm trying. This is just like a very fine, nuanced conversation, and I ultimately believe that consumers have the choice to be able to pursue companies that have those sort of values embedded into them. In so much as they don't have that in a company, then they're free to leave.
You understand what I'm saying, Brooke? I agree with what you're saying. But should we want that, though, as Americans? Should we want companies to be vibrant protectors of free speech and to have a culture of free speech within their organization? Do we want that?
I, as an American, want that. There may be other Americans that don't want that, and that's on them.
Okay, perfect. I think we're all in agreement. It took a while to get there, but I think
but we made it.
And I know there's no easy answers. I know there's no, you know, I understand that there's no easy answers when it comes to these questions in terms of, you know, government policy and how do we regulate. I agree with all that, but I do see a lot of concern in this aspect. And I don't think just saying, well, we can go this way or we can go that way and go our own separate ways is a healthy response. I think it's a response, but I don't know if it's the healthiest response.
Yeah, I mean, Ray, just to finish up here, I certainly get a lot of people's concerns. I would just kind of finish by saying content moderation is hard. If you've ever done it, there's a lot of questionable things that go up every day that really push people's commitment to free speech and free ideas and stuff that said. And I'm just glad that we have Section 230, which kind of allows different companies to do what they want without being liable. And it, as people are kind of pushing to try to get the internet that they want, I would just suggest that they try to use the right tool, perhaps trimmers rather than cutting down the whole tree. That seems to be the tack that a lot of people are taking right now. And again, point out that both those on the left and the right are asking for the same thing, but they think they're going to get very different outcomes. And I would like people to think through that.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, there's a lot of discussion here. I'm worried about the culture of censorship in America, and I think other people should be too. It's a concern for me, and it's getting worse, and it's not getting better in many respects. I understand that social media, agree with all of you, that it has allowed a voice to a lot of people, and a lot of people that probably don't need a voice, and I agree with that as well. But, I see a lot of things getting worse and not better. And so, you know, my hope is the market can solve that, but there's a lot of powerful tech companies that are empowering people that are kind of enemies of America, to be honest. And so that can be a concern. And I can agree with the methods of the free market all day, but I can also be aware of the concerns that are going on.
Definitely. Definitely. This was a robust conversation, and I think there's a lot of thoughts on here, and I think it's good that we wrestle with these issues because I believe there's a consensus that can be found on these things, but it requires us really deliberating and debating the merits of censorship versus free speech writ large and just how to wrestle with that. So thank you guys both for this conversation. I think it's been good, and hopefully our audience has found it enlightening. And so if you have additional thoughts on this, feel free to shoot us an email. Give us your thoughts on what you think regarding this fine line between free speech, censorship, where tech needs to be involved, where they don't. But radio@nccivitas.org is our email address. Again, that's radio@nccivitas.org.
Thank you, Brooke.
Brooke and I are going to talk about the new mask mandate, and it takes effect in North Carolina Friday at 5 p.m. There's some exemptions, and we'll get into a little bit of that. But Brooke, I mean, we're staying in phase two now, no 2.5 or 3, and we have to wear masks in public. And it looks like the enforcement mechanisms are going to be on businesses to kind of police that and to enforce that. And if they don't, they can be fined or they can be cited and they can run into their own problems. So what are your initial thoughts, Brooke, on the governor's decision?
So, yes, like you mentioned, phase two is now extended and effective Friday, June 27th. So if you're listening to this, it's already in effect.
Yeah, and it's July 17th, right, is the next decision date or something? Isn't it all the way to
July 17th? July 17th, phase two has been extended to. And the mandatory mask mandate is effective on Friday, June 27th at 5 p.m. So this is the deal. There are a lot of people that I'm hearing from, and I know many in our audience, as I monitor the social media comments, that are having none of this. And even within my own friend group, I've been talking to some of them about it, and I'm getting a mixed bag of responses. But I think here's the crux of it when you're in a public policy space like Civitas, is it constitutional for the governor to issue a statewide mask mandate that requires businesses to be the almost law enforcement mechanism of this? And so it's one thing for private businesses to require masks. I mean, Costco does, and I put on a mask when I go into Costco. Mm-hmm. But under threat of fine or trespassing charges, should businesses be required to uphold this? Sounds like some sheriff's offices do not think so. And so there's more than a couple, I think, at this point that refuse to enforce this mask mandate, right?
And I think a lot of private businesses are going to be worried about their employees because we've already seen videos on social medias where there's been interactions with people trying to go into a Walmart or some other store where they have these mask mandates and someone trying to stop them. and they've already gotten into like some wrestling matches, some spats. I know that there was a killing in Flint, Michigan, and there may have been other violence related to this. So it puts more strain, an already a strenuous environment, on cashiers, people who work at doors, you know, hired security. It's going to put more strain on them. So to me, it just kind of seemed a little bit like a political cop-out from the governor to say, well, I don't want to risk my political capital too much. So I don't want, you know, the police or other law enforcement entities going around enforcing my edict because it could come back and bite me in the bottom. And so I'm just going to kind of put this on the companies and create a little bit more of a buffer
You
know, from the political decisions.
Companies that he has, by his mandate, kept closed for many, many weeks. And some, obviously, now they can't even reopen when they initially thought they could. So we've got gyms and bars on the brink of complete closure permanently. But then those that were in phase two, I mean, he's putting a lot of onus on them after already depriving them of the ability to implement safety protocols earlier on. How many of these businesses would have actually gladly accepted a forced mask mandate, I guess, or at least a business one, not even a government one, earlier on, provided they were allowed to reopen their businesses? And so just the arbitrariness of this, it seems arbitrary in some ways, because so much of the data that we're getting from the governor's administration on COVID numbers is very, very veiled. And so Leah Byers, our policy analyst, she's written about this on our website, just about how there's not definitive numbers and benchmarks that the Cooper administration has set out. And so how long are we going to be wearing these masks for? How long until phase three really happens? I mean, we know at least until July 17th, but what's to say that's not going to get pushed further down the road? And what benchmarks are we expecting the COVID numbers to meet before we can actually count on reopening? We don't know these answers yet.
No, those are all good points. And we don't know we're seeing more evidence that masks are effective in terms of, at least to me, when you look at some of these graphs in some of these states where they have some mandates, but we don't know. There's so many variables to consider. Like you said, it's hard to get at that aspect because we don't have full transparency from our state government at that point. And so, yeah, I don't know. I have no problem wearing a mask if a business wants me to wear a mask. I know we've talked about that before on the podcast. No issue at all. But yeah, to me, there's just going to be some people that are not going to comply. And it looks like, you know, you mentioned the sheriff's department, there may not be enforcement. So I really think the governor should have just owned this a little bit more and said, this is the way it's going to be. And, you know, if he needs to use law enforcement to enforce that, I thought that would have been the better tact, at least.
Do you think he has the constitutional authority to require mask use across the state?
I don't know. I don't want to speculate on that because I'm going to be honest and say I don't know. And I haven't read much to form an opinion on that yet. I know that there's been some writing out there. I just haven't read it yet. So I don't know if you have a view on that you want to share. I'll let you take the hit, Brooke. But I just don't know. I know that other states have broader sort of mask enforcement executive orders or guidelines or however you want to call it right now.
Yeah, I'll be honest. And I'm still waiting to hear some of the state constitutional experts come out on this. And so I think that's forthcoming. So I'll defer to them on that front. But that is something that I'm curious about we've been skeptical of the governor's emergency powers for quite some time now in some of his handling, especially as it pertains to statewide orders rather than allowing cities and municipalities to make some of these decisions themselves. He obviously does have emergency powers, but there's been some vagueness as it pertains to whether or not he needs concurrence from the Council of State on a lot of these decisions. And so far he's foregone that concurrence, that is. So it's something that those that are very much interested in constitutional issues should be keeping their eyes on.
And, you know, it'd be helpful to get a statement from the Attorney General, you know, saying, is this constitutional? Is it not constitutional? I think things like that are important as the chief kind of law enforcement officer in the state. I don't have seen anything from Stein yet, Josh Stein, but it'd be helpful to just kind of get, you know, his take on this and, you know, what are kind of some effective enforcement measures, you know, to see. It seems like to me, you're right, on the whole Council of State stuff is we've only heard from Governor Cooper and he's kind of micromanaged this to some degree. There are other elected officials in the state, and I'd like to hear more from them too. I mean, we hear from Forrest from a campaign perspective, but not maybe as much as a lieutenant governor, besides, you know, him and Cooper just being in disagreement on about everything at the moment. So it is tricky to navigate. I don't have all the answers yet, but so I'm headed.
Yeah, I believe a lawsuit's coming, according to Forrest's office. I believe he's suing on this front. So
one of my problems, Brooke, is why can't, if you're going to have the mask, you know, enforce the mask, why can't people go back to bars? I mean, we could talk about gyms, but why not even bars, I guess? I mean, we're going to continue with this phase two, keep some businesses locked down, virtually destroying them. We already know that. I mean, some have already just been destroyed, but it'll just string this out longer and more businesses, of course, will have to close. To me, that's, I think this, because I was talking to somebody, I had to get something minor done on my car the other day, and we were talking about the gym situation, and he talked about how the owner of his gym had built, he'd done these like glass partitions, and he was making it where there could be single spaces to kind of work out where you're basically enclosed at his gym. And so there's people
that
are innovative and do these things to open the back of their business. But we have these mandates that just say, no, sorry, if you're classified under this, you can't open no matter what you do. And I think that's frustrating for a lot of North Carolinians. It's frustrating for a lot of people nationally. And to me, that you just have to have these sort of one-size-fits-all mandates, they just hardly ever work. And so, you know, that frustration, I think, is just seeping in with more and more people.
Yeah. It gives the businesses a fighting chance. That's my thought on it. And I understand the critical importance of safety as it pertains to this. So I say it shouldn't be either or. It shouldn't be safety or, you know, just reopening. And it shouldn't be lives over livelihood or versus livelihoods. Right. I think there is a middle road that we can achieve. And so our hearts go out to all of those businesses and you entrepreneurs that are struggling right now. You're definitely in our thoughts. And so if you have any additional thoughts on this, or this definitely hits home personally for you, we want to hear from you. So feel free to shoot us an email at radio@nccivitas.org. We would love feedback on this. We welcome you all's thoughts.
Absolutely.
You guys have a wonderful week. Thank you.